website is mentioned on the bottom of the flyer, www.manyriversbooks.com. Thank you. All right, so this is a talk entitled Belief and Evidence in Spiritual Practice. And it arose for us to do this talk for several reasons. One is that lately there's been an awful lot, there have been a number of books published, an awful lot of discussion in the general public media, this country at least, about the role of evidence in spiritual practice. People have been coming at that question in terms of is there evidence for the existence of God, or is there evidence that would support religious beliefs, the religious beliefs of the major religions. And I'm thinking here of books like The God Delusion by Richard Dawkins, The End of Faith by Sam Harris, and Letter to a Christian Nation by Sam Harris as well. There's one I haven't read, a recent one I saw a rather unfavorable review of recently, just today actually, by Chris Hedges.
Christopher Hitchens.
Sorry, Christopher Hitchens, entitled God is Not Great. And so it seems to be a topic that's in the general blogosphere, at least, and logosphere, whatever you want to call it. But it's of interest to us in particular at Taiyu Meditation Center, precisely because long before this topic was of interest to most people, it was something that back in the 1970s, when I first became a student of Taiyu Meditation Center, was a central and key point that was a preliminary to all our spiritual practice. And that is the notion that one should never accept propositions without evidence. That is, that doesn't mean that some propositions don't require activities to gather and evaluate evidence that might not take years or even decades to do. But nevertheless, one should never accept a proposition without evidence. And this was presented to me as a foundational view for spiritual practice. If spiritual practice, as it was presented to me, is indeed the process of self-inquiry, is the process by which we come to know ourselves at the most profound level, in the most comprehensive way that we can find to do, and it's a process, not a destination, in one sense at least, then why wouldn't we keep looking for new evidence? Why would we stop having had a so-called capital T truth revealed to us? Why would we stop looking at evidence? The universe is constantly throwing out evidence at us about its nature. And we are constantly leaving evidence in our wake about our own natures. So that's sort of the place where I'm beginning, at least for this talk. It's these two points, which are not by any means coincident, but they do seem to me to point to a proposition that I'm going to offer for your consideration tonight and your continuing investigation, if you so choose, and that is that the essence of spiritual practice is indeed an ongoing investigation of the nature of life, the nature of what we're doing here, the nature of what's going on around us, etc. This may involve the material world and a putative non-material reality as well. I don't exclude that. And one of the things that we do here at the store is 3 weeks out of four, on Tuesday nights we have a class called "Dude, Where's My Soul?" And that investigation is explicitly aimed at looking at ways that we might find evidence for the existence of the non-phenomenal realm within the phenomenal realm that our consciousness is seen tied to here. But we'll get to that further. So that's kind of where I'm starting, is from those two directions, and we'll see what we can uncover together this evening.
So I'm want to return a bit to the books that Rob had mentioned. You know, there's it's an interesting phenomenon now in publication circles that militant atheism is becoming respectable again, and I think that's actually a welcome response to the strong push for religion and a certain kind of fundamental doctrine that seems to be infecting the world right now. And so a lot of these books, like particularly the Sam Harris's End of Faith, are very articulate in expressing a fundamental problem with religion. And, you know, these books like Dawkins' book, The God Delusion, is much more from a scientific sociobiology point of view, where everything's kind of reduced down to a material realm. But what I find interesting with Harris's work is that he's much more intellectually honest, in that he acknowledges that there are certain questions and about the nature of our being and certain traditions. You know, he acknowledges, for instance, much of the Buddhist tradition that have technologies of self-inquiry that are extremely sophisticated by Western philosophical traditional grounds. And the issue that he takes on is what the idea that unquestioned faith, that belief in some sort of idea or some sort of story without question, is an acceptable mode of engagement with the world. And his issue is that somehow in American society, and this is common in many other societies, we exclude the realm of religion from the kind of critical analysis that we would expect to see in law or medicine or engineering or any other, even in literature for that matter. Because if someone trots out the idea that, the Bible says this is so, or I believe this is so, all of a sudden you can't touch it because it's someone's religion. And we're a very open and accepting society, so people's religions shouldn't be called out to question. People should have their religions, we should respect their religions. And he's making a claim that, well, no, we shouldn't, because some people's religions actually cause them to do things like fly airplanes into buildings or put bombs into abortion clinics or all the sorts of things that very strongly motivated emotional faith-driven people will do. And the thing that's interesting about this discussion, and I think the thing that we take issue with those kinds of books, is that they often don't give enough play for a different kind of engagement or a different kind of spiritual engagement. That it isn't necessary and it's not required that we take things on faith about the nature of ourselves, the nature about reality, the nature of the meaning of our lives. It's certainly the case, like in any sort of inquiry, that we have to occasionally hold hypotheses. That is, we have to look at a proposition and then to engage that proposition by putting it to the test in our lives. And as a result of that test, we can draw some real conclusions or some real data about whether or not the proposition has any sort of objective merit for ourselves. But it's not necessary in genuine spiritual inquiry, like Rob was describing, for us to accept things on blind faith and then stop. And I think that's the strongest critique about the fundamentalist mindset, and I would include that mindset, whether it's in the scientific world or the religious world, which is that ordinary consciousness tends to operate in a way in which people will often latch onto a belief and then hold that as the truth, and then not do any further inquiry around that belief. That belief then becomes like a fact in their existence and is not subject to further inquiry. And we find that in order to do the work of proper spiritual practice, that we have to become extremely vigilant about when in ourselves we are believing in certain things or taking certain things on faith, as it were, and the point at which we resist or avoid putting things to the test. And so I think that will be an interesting realm for us to go further in our discussion. But just at the preliminary level, you know, the place that I come from in this discussion, in this inquiry, is a very strong experience and a very strong position that genuine spiritual practice is an objective practice. It's a practice of uncovering the truth about ourselves and about the world, and that truth is accessible to us directly. The practice, if you will, is learning systematically to peel away the untruths that we identify with or hold that keep us from seeing the deeper truth about our natures. And so faith and belief tend to be the obstacles that we have to work against in order to create what in the Fourth Way tradition Gurdjieff referred to as objective reason. If we cultivate objective reason, you know, our claim is that there is a knowing, there is a direct sensing of the universe that is available to us that is as objective as opening your eyes. And, you know, we can get into a side conversation about how objective that is, but certainly from an experiential point of view, we don't have to hold beliefs on blind faith. We can simply see, and our hearts can tell us what is what. And that's what we try to work towards in spiritual practice.
So, I can go on, but let me just check in to see if there are any questions, comments that people have. Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about the difference in spiritual practice between objectivity and subjectivity?
Mm-hmm.
Because it seems to me that it's also very deeply subjective. When you take, because if there's an objective, there's an observer. And what you're trying to do is not to transcend that observed process.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question in the sense that in my experience, the paradox is that spiritual practice is in a way being objective about our subjectivity. And you know, I'm not playing a game there, but it's like the spiritual realm, the non-phenomenal realm, if you will, the non-formal realm that we can measure is intimately subjective. But that doesn't mean that it's not available to being present to, or not available to direct experience. And I think that the So when I say we learn to be objective about our subjectivity, we learn to put our attention in such a way that we can be present to that subjectivity, and also learn to see where what I'd call subjectivity with a small s gets started, which is when we identify a particular class of experiences with our identity. In other words, if I have a certain kind of habitual emotional reaction, there's a normal human tendency to identify oneself with that. So, I am mad, and that means that I have to do something about it in a particular way. When we learn through spiritual practice to, for instance, behold the arising of the emotion, anger, in the functioning of this organism, but there's a place that is observing that is not the anger, then that's what I would call, in a way, being objective about our subjectivity. So we begin to see that there are these experiences, this functioning of this organism that we inhabit, that provides interesting thoughts, interesting emotions, interesting sensations, that from an unconscious place we tend to assume is who we are. And by cultivating a kind of attention that can see beyond that, we can begin to not only recognize that that's not the complete story of who we are, but we can also turn our attention to something more ineffable that is present always, that is a very subjective, you know, the subjectivity of consciousness, the sort of the beingness or the awareness of consciousness. And in that way, we strip away that experience from all the things that we identify with it, or the ways we color it, or the names and measurements we give it, and become, as I said, objective about our subjectivity. Does that make sense, or does it?
Okay.
I'll just expand on that a little bit to say that what Stuart's referring to in our tradition is the basic tool that we use, the basic meditative tool that we use, and that's called self-observation meditation. So it's a very precise and specific way to establish a viewpoint in consciousness that does not partake of the usual aspects of egoic consciousness. And so, having done that, that gives us the opportunity to observe throughout our lives, in mundane and extraordinary moments, what's going on. Eventually, that function fades. It dissolves because the ultimate goal is this merging of subjectivity and objectivity in the sense that Stuart's describing. But that's the result of great efforts and long practice. And so, but I just wanted to throw that in there since it more completely answers your question. So thank you. You had a question?
Well, I wonder how this compares with how science proceeds, the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And there in the sciences there is a great distrust, I think, against the individual observer. And objectivity is not a state for a scientist to be in, but it's more maybe a method or an ideal endpoint.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe objectivity is better captured by, in some preliminary sense, as intersubjectivity.
As?
Intersubjectivity. So that when people agree on things, and so then there's the whole tendency of starting to measure things, breeding instruments, theorizing about measurement outcomes.
So how is
it possible then to come to objectivity while this is still considered to be a state of an individual, which I don't think that's not considered to be, at least as far as I understand the sciences, objectivity is not a state of an individual.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure Stuart will have a response to this, but I'll just throw in something really quick, which is that I am not only interested in, nor do I assume the only subject of my objective investigation, as objective as I can make it. It's not the only subject of my this phenomenal world, this organism, this subjectivity, as it's often described in some circles, is not the only object of my observation. So, in fact, if my observation goes deeply enough, it extends to everything that I'm able to be aware of in the phenomenal world, and perhaps, as well, to things from the non-phenomenal world or realm as well. And so that's one part of that would be one part of the answer, is that I agree with you, it can't be just about an individual's response or point of view. And your point about science being essentially, you said it, intersubjective, and I might say it's something where people attempt to come to common agreements about things that they can mutually verify. And some of this stuff can be verified by individuals, as I implied earlier, if they are willing to put in the extraordinary efforts necessary to direct their attention in such a way over a long period of time and with great persistence and energy to investigate certain of the questions that would penetrate this subjectivity-objectivity distinction. But I want to hear more what Stuart has to say, too.
Well, I have a couple of responses to the question. One, this notion of intersubjectivity is interesting because you could certainly argue that any sort of group behavior, like science as a group phenomenon, ultimately depends on the agreement of the participants, and so there's a sort of a group phenomenon or a group subjectivity that we all agree to call something objective because we happen to agree on it. But that leads into one aspect of my response, which is actually this issue is addressed in Sam Harris's book, The End of Faith. He points out that there are plenty of realms in various schools of thought or knowledge that deal with classes of phenomena that can't be exteriorized in the way that certain scientific, physical things can be exteriorized. An example in the psychological realm, ultimately, what does it mean to speak about anger in a psychological realm? At some point, there's a discourse among participants in a group of knowing that comes to some agreement that pinpoints anger in both exterior manifestations of the organism and in maybe physiological responses that are observed in the organism. But the one thing that none of those measurements can ever do is to measure the inherent subjectivity of what it feels like when you're angry. And yet there's some sense and some consistency in being able to say that you're angry or you're angry or you're angry in a given circumstance. And so there's lots of examples in ordinary life where we can find some consistencies and explore realms of knowledge without the requirement that we exteriorize the measurement of everything. And so having said that, then, I would apply the same to classes of spiritual practice because, ultimately, although I can never, prove to you what my subjective, internal, innermost experience is, we can both participate in a consistent set of practices that lead to, for all exterior intents and purposes, some experience of agreement that we seem to be seeing things in a similar way. And so spiritual traditions often involve, methodologies that participants involve themselves in that will reliably produce, at least to exteriorize, a consistent set of experiences. And then the participants, through this process of intersubjectivity, will all agree, we seem to be talking about the same thing. We may never know in some absolute sense, but operationally or practically, we do know that somehow by doing this meditative practice, my life is changing in ways that I articulate in a way that's similar to what someone else is articulating. And so in that sense, I find that there's meaning to speaking in terms of objectivity with a footnote, and I think you make an appropriate footnote, but speaking about objectivity in an engagement like spiritual practice. Ultimately, though, it's also the case that only you can know and make conclusions about the nature of your existence. Because I can say all sorts of wonderful things, but in the end, you're the one who's in there. You're the operator of this particular laboratory, and it's for you to determine for yourself what is objective. And like any good scientist, you know, science and the success of science rests on the integrity of the scientists who participate in it. And a good scientist is always willing to put their hypotheses to the test. They're always willing to do experiments, and they're more interested in truth than they are in being right. So to the extent that we can bring that same kind of scientific integrity to our spiritual practice, then I think we have a useful guide, or a useful pattern, if you will, to lead us towards a deeper understanding of the nature of our existence.
So I'm going to throw in another aspect of this, is that there's a danger in this realm, but in other, it's the same danger exists in other realms, that, as Stuart points out, we can be misled by the consensus, the social consensus that exists around us. If we were living in Kansas, you know, we would be in a minority if we were to deny the veracity of the Bible as the Word of God, right? But does that mean that that's wrong to do that? That it's wrong to make this investigation? Of course not. In my view, in the view that we're offering for consideration tonight. And this is a realm, this realm of metaphysics, this realm of exploration of consciousness and of reality in the way that ways that we're talking about, is a realm that's very slippery, very difficult to get a consensus about, number one. And even if there is a consensus, you have to always question that consensus. One of the strengths of Buddhism, one of the reasons why Harris points to Buddhism as having what Stuart called a technology for investigation of these matters, is precisely that they have looked for verifiable by multiple individuals, verifiable techniques that can allow for investigation of questions of consciousness that don't rest upon a foundation of faith. And that's the key scientific perspective, if you will, to continue to respond to your question, in my view.
There is something similar happening in the sciences, but I think it's slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
In the sciences, we don't... When people were thinking about do atoms exist or not, there was some evidence for that. But the moment that we really started having an understanding and a belief in the existence of this level of fundamental matter was when there were different methods that triangulated to the same points.
Mm-hmm.
So you could use different theories and do different calculations, and they gave you more or less the same number.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a scientific point of view, it would be still insufficient to say, okay, here we have 20 people who all follow the same method, it's very long, it's a very demanding training, and lo and behold, at the end of 20 years, they agree that they all experience this. Because, and call that objectivity, because it is still possible that these experiences are generated by that very same method that they went to, which in itself could be a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it does not necessarily expose an independent feature of reality,
mm-hmm.
as in the sciences, I think we're asking for. Do atoms exist independent of us? Are they not just artifacts of a certain
investigation
or instrumentation or stuff like that? So we need to bring in four different roads to the same thing that we can somehow tie together.
I got you. I think Stuart is chomping at the bit here.
Well, your point, I agree with your point in the sense that, but I think the issue or the challenges in scientific exploration are similar in the regard that you're describing to spiritual exploration, in that, you know, first, we're not saying that the methodology is that you sort of do this black box experience for 20 years, and then at the end of that, you know, you all sort of compare your results and say, do we know something objective about reality? In the spiritual process, it is more of a directional thing, in the sense that if I engage in a particular path or a particular practice, there should be milestones that are, you know, within a certain realm of expectation for me to feel like it makes sense to continue in this way. And so in that sense, there are intermediary points of checking, so that I would call the consensus making more a process of refining. And at some point, if you find that what you come to understand is different from everyone else, then that's data for you to either test against with further experiments, or to conclude that the claims or the methodologies or the position taken by this so-called group is not valid for you. But in a good, robust spiritual tradition, there are orthogonal methodologies for elucidating different aspects of the nature of one's existence. And
what do you mean by orthogonal?
Coming from opposite or different dimensions. And yeah, sorry.
I knew what you meant, but I didn't think everyone ever did.
Thank you. So we are trying to, you know, by using these different directions or methodologies, trying to come at a problem or a question of the nature of ourselves from many different directions, if it's a robust tradition. And what I take as one of the benefits of practicing spiritual practice in the modern world is that because we have exposure to many different traditions, there's actually an opportunity, if one has the appropriate integrity, to test their understanding against the methodologies in a number of different traditions, as a way of just checking in to see whether what you've been doing is, covers the complete, bases of the dimensions of oneself. The other thing I'd just like to conclude with on this is that, like science, spiritual practice is an ongoing process. I mean, you mentioned that we gain an understanding of the atom, but we don't. Honest scientists are going to say we're ever at a point of truth. It's always a progressive process of an ever-refining understanding of questions to ask, methodologies to consistently answer questions about the nature of the exterior world. And I would say similarly in a spiritual context, it's a mistake to ever conclude that we're ever done. That there's an ongoing refining or an ongoing inquiry that continues through this life and, you know, according to some models, multiple lives. Again, something we get to test in our direct experience. And that the moment we say we're done, the moment we say we're enlightened, or that we are, a seventh stage adept or something like that.
Whether we know the basic secrets of the universe,
right,
and there's no more to find out about that.
Then we look as pompous as Richard Dawkins does when he promotes the God delusion. You know, it's a certain amount of humility is useful in spiritual practice, just like it's useful in scientific endeavors.
Right. The distinction I would make is that it's the similarities I would want to point to between the methodology of science and the methodology of spiritual practice, as we're explicating it here, is one of attitude, a similarity in attitude, and that attitude is one that Stuart has just articulated. It is an attitude that I never can stop questioning. Or, to put it another way, for a moment, this is the way things seem to me. But as soon as one tiny little bit of evidence comes along that contradicts that, Or maybe it's a tiny little bit of evidence that is enough to make me say, oh, I had it 180 degrees. It's actually this way. When we have that attitude towards evidence, when we have that attitude towards ideas and beliefs, that is the essence of non-identification in a spiritual context, and it is the essence of a genuine regard for truth in a scientific context, where, as Stuart said, the attitude is not, I'm going to prove my theory is correct and advance my career and make, you know, be famous and so forth.
Get lots of followers.
Got lots of grad student followers, yeah, and that sort of thing. But instead, I'm going to find out what's actually true. So it's the attitude that makes the difference. And what we're saying is that in much mainstream religion, maybe most mainstream religion, as practiced by most people, the foundation is not that attitude. In contrast, the foundation is, I was told that this is the way it is, and that's the way it's going to be. And that's the distinction. So that's why I'm glad you asked the question about scientism and, you know, scientific methodology and inquiry, because in many ways what we're advocating in the realm of metaphysics, spiritual practice, self-inquiry, et cetera, is exactly that same attitude. So, thank you. You had a question.
Yeah. I actually saw Sam Harris on C-SPAN a month or so ago.
Which one was it?
He was debating a fairly liberal Muslim scholar.
Oh, really interesting.
And it was narrated by Richard Kirshner, an author who's written a lot of really interesting books about Judaism, kind of popularizing different things about Judaism and different religions too.
Mm-hmm.
When Sam Harris makes an assertion like Buddhism has a scientific approach, I mean, you could say that from a certain point of view as a Westerner with a background in science. But the truth is that most Buddhist practitioners are embedded in a mythic story about the universe, just as most Christian practitioners, and even to some degree, you know, I'd say anybody who's doing a spiritual practice, there's always some sort of background mythical narrative going on.
Mm-hmm.
And in some traditions, you don't question that at all, or you question it at your own peril, or you question it to yourself, but you don't necessarily bring it up to everybody else. I used to be the student of a Tibetan Buddhist teacher who was really one of the more amazing beings I ever met, and I felt was the most spiritually advanced in a balanced way out of anybody I've ever met.
Mm-hmm.
And he was deeply embedded in this mythic Tibetan narrative about Padmasambhava, and who was born in a lotus flower, and
mm-hmm.
you know, I saw a couple of Westerners ask him if Padmasambhava was real, and he'd just look at them like they were crazy. I think that to some degree, having that kind of a mythical narrative is inherent in spiritual practice, and you're not going to be able to completely eliminate it, but have to develop some sort of healthy way of looking at a relationship to it. You know,
mm-hmm.
whether it's about Buddha or Jesus or Lao Tzu and the Tao or Gurdjieff.
Well, I'm happy to respond to that.
Sure.
I think that you state the case quite well, that almost everyone, including and Harris even points out in his book, to give him credit, that most Buddhists, in fact, do, although he doesn't use the same words as you, relate to relate to Buddhism, not as the sort of spiritual inquiry that we're talking about, but on this sort of mythic level that, in terms of a story that gives meaning to their lives, mm-hmm. For various reasons, and the practices that they do. And in one sense, I have absolutely no problem with that. There's no problem with it. The difficulty always arises in how hard do you hold on to any one particular idea or belief. And a mythos, a meaningful collective mythos or a meaningful personal mythos is nothing more than an elaborate idea. Okay? The metaphor for a healthy relationship to ideas that I like to use, because I have training in archaeology, is the one that people used to have with relationship to tools, the basic fundamental tools that most of humans use throughout the history of the human race, and that is stone tools. At least the ones that we have records of that have survived in the archaeological record. And what we can see quite clearly is that people didn't carry the tools around with them. They would fashion them on the spot to accomplish a certain function, and then they discard them. And then when they need a new tool in some other spot, they'd fashion a new tool and discard that. When we have the relationship of non-identification with these gigantic ideas, mythic structures, and more narrowly construed belief systems, and individual beliefs about particular things in our own lives, in our own story narrative that we tell ourselves. When we have a relationship to those things that we can put down when we're not using it anymore, that is, that we don't carry it around in this ego pouch in our heads, ready to pop out at any time, but rather, whenever we need a similar idea, we fashion it on the spot, without reference to the contents of the ego pouch, then that's a different relationship. That's in many ways what the fundamentals of spiritual practice are meant to accomplish in the first great effort, the first great push of spiritual practice, is to change your habits of identification with the ego. And that means having a different relationship to the ideas, including the great down to the small that you were just speaking of, as well as the emotional habits of identification. I get angry whenever someone says, "You look sad." Or, "I get angry," or, "I get sad whenever someone says, "You look angry." Or whatever it happens to be. And as well with identifications about the body. These bodies are actually far more plastic than we tell ourselves. The narratives we tell ourselves about our bodies are very static, and our identifications with those are also obstacles. So, in these three realms, we have habits such that we tend to grasp onto, and hold onto, and carry around stories about who we are, what the universe is like, how the universe should treat us, how the universe actually does treat us, and why it's so unfair that there's this distinction between the two, etc., etc., etc. And thus we carry our suffering around with us and generate it through that ego pouch, instead of being like prehistoric hunter-gatherers, wandering around, chipping a tool when we need it, and dropping it as soon as we're done defleshing the antelope or whatever.
I'd like to add a couple responses also from a slightly different tack.
I'll bet.
I'm not an archaeologist.
A slightly different tack, I mean, right?
I'm not an archaeologist. The first, I just did to Sam Harris, I want to point out that somewhere, and I'm not sure if it's in the, I think it was in an interview I read with him or something, or an essay he wrote, that he makes reference to the Baroque religiosity of Buddhism. So his resolution of the paradox that you described is to say, here are the objective tools of Buddhism, and here's the religiosity, and I'm going to sort through those things and find the objective practices. Now, I'm not advocating that. I actually think that that Harris is somewhat lopsided and has a blind spot in this area. But I have a different interpretation of what you're describing, and the touchstone for me is a discussion in Gurdjieff's masterwork All and Everything about the notion of allegory. So there's this very lucid discussion in that book at one point where he's describing that contemporary beings on the planet Earth have really lost the ability to of allegorical thinking. And this comes up in the context of a chapter on religion. And he's, in the context of the book, Beelzebub is telling his grandson about how screwed up the people on the planet Earth are. And one of the issues is that they have these religious stories, these holy books, and they treat them like they're the literal truth. And they relate to them like they're the literal truth. And we see that now today, where people read stuff in the Bible, read stuff in the Buddhist canon, or read stuff in the Quran, and treat it like it's as objective as this chair in the room, and therefore draw conclusions about what they should do in their lives. And that's a kind of insanity, because what allegorical thinking is, in the way Gurdjieff describes it very, very precisely, is a kind of thinking that takes place when not only the intellectual center but the emotional center is also engaged in active mentation. What that means is, to kind of use the language we were talking about earlier, is that there's this orthogonal or this separate channel of relating to the world or information gathering through our emotional center that has a completely different language than the language of the intellectual center. And complete understanding and complete apperception of the nature of reality requires that we turn all of these channels of information gathering on at once. Because they have different languages, the net interaction is to come up with something that is more spacious and fuller and richer and more satisfying than a strictly intellectual kind of rectilinear breakdown of the world around us. And so older religious traditions tend to be embedded in an allegorical substrate, but that allegorical substrate is another channel of information that's as valid, but it is different than the kind of objectivity that we relate to through the intellectual center. And so it's not that those are valid or invalid, even asking, is Padmasambhava real? Mm-hmm. The response, I would guess, from your teacher was that the question doesn't make any sense.
Right.
It the question doesn't compute, because it's like you're kind of talking past each other in one sense. And in that way, allegory, we don't have to subject allegory to the same criteria that we do when we're measuring electron orbitals around a hydrogen atom. We do, however, we can relate to them in a certain way, but the moment that we kind of cross ground and say that Padmasambhava's sitting here right in the chair and he's telling me that I should go out and drive my car into a side of a building, then something's gone wrong, because we've kind of crossed circuits, and that's dysfunctional behavior. So we can enrich our experience with the allegorical. It is a piece that is another data channel, if you will, or another experiential channel for us to gather information about the nature of our presence in this universe. But it's not the only thing, and it's not the same as the kind of realm of exterior existence that we find ourselves in a body.
Yeah, I want to make the point even stronger, and that is to say that in my view, and you can take it for what it's worth, without, you know, you would need to confirm this in your own experience. But in my view, it is, there are spaces, there are places in the universe where it is absolutely true that Padmasambhava was born in a lotus and abides in whatever realm he abides in, and that that information is more crucial to know than the electron orbitals of an atom in this particular space. So it's important to recognize that these different visions of reality have their utilities in their places. You know, Padmasambhava is not going to help you in the physics lab. And similarly, you know, your cloud chamber is not going to help you on top of a mountain in Tibet. So,
unless you're trying to capture neutrinos or something. You know.
Thanks. My point is, as Stuart well knows, there are different places to be. There are different states to experience. And no one state is greater or lesser inherently than another. They are simply different places. And in those different places, these things are of greater utility or lesser utility. It isn't that electron orbitals don't exist in the realm that Padmasambhava hangs out in. It's just that that information is not particularly useful there compared with the knowledge that Padmasambhava was born of a lotus. See, if you can hold that view, if you can really hold that view and simultaneously hold the view that there are electron orbitals happening in the realm, in that realm as well, and all the other views that are there, then you've done something. That's an accomplishment. One of the main problems that spiritual practice is designed to liberate us from is this this inhabitants of successive spaces that cannot overlap with each other. That's limiting. That's why we talk about it as liberation. We liberate ourselves from our habits which keep us stuck in one place. And most people get stuck in one place their whole lifetime in this body, to a greater or lesser extent, when we're talking about like a myth or religious mythos.
Mm-hmm.
On other levels, people change their belief system. People will be a Marxist when they're 20 and a neocon when they're 40 and a God knows what when they're 60. You know, those things happen all the time. But when you're there, that's the truth, right? At least that's what you believe. And in a certain space, that truth is true. The problem is when you try to take that into a different space and insist that this is the way it is. No, you know.
It's the way it is for everybody.
Yeah, this is the way it is for everybody, everywhere, at every time, in every place, etc. Doesn't work. That's why I recommend that attitude of pick up the idea when it's useful. Use it. Toss it when you're done with it. Not toss it in the sense of you'll never look at it again, but if you pick it up fresh next time, it won't be the same idea. It won't be the same stone tool that you create. It'll be a different stone tool. In fact, that happens inevitably anyway, and that's how belief systems change gradually over time. Even in ones with massive inertia, like the Catholic Church or something like that, those belief systems have mutated over time. That sort of thing is inevitable, but we tell ourselves that they don't, because that's what the ego wants to insure against. So you had a question first. Okay.
Yeah, it seems like kind of what you're talking about is you're trying to do follow a logical path, trying to find out what the illogical answer is.
Okay.
You know, I mean, just take something that nobody can actually really know, such as, say, God, but we try all these logical things to make to prove to ourselves or the company or the religion, you know, whatever, that does exist.
I got that. Actually, I'm not sure that you can't know God in a certain way,
depending on different times.
But I will agree that most people proceed illogically, in the sense that we've been saying, in that they insist on bringing a particular set of assumptions to every set of experiences, whether that's relevant or not in those new and unique contexts.
Well, yeah, it's like if they believe in God, you know, they find, at least in their own head, the logical step that, yeah, there's a God because you can do it logically.
Mm-hmm.
But then you find somebody else who, say, an atheist who doesn't believe in God,
mm-hmm.
and you can't, and he goes logically around his path to say no, that God doesn't exist,
mm-hmm.
but we're still talking about an illogical place, or an untangible place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all these paths have their roots all mapped out. You know, you can go to Buddhism and going into the self. But what you finally find is that intangible, that liberated experience that you can't find in words.
Okay.
We try all these words to say what it is, but it's like a feeling. It's something you can't explain. And that's the illogical part of it, the untangible part.
Okay, see, I wouldn't call that illogical. That would be my distinction.
If it would make sense to you, say a Buddhist, but then you try and convince a Christian.
Well, the difference,
you know, but you know, we're basically talking about the same thing, just different paths. You just got to. It's like you're more open to your path than, say, a Christian would be, and a Christian is more open to his path than you would be.
Well, but the problem is if you bring it, I got what you said, but the problem with that view is that then no one ever can do anything better, either than they've done before or than anyone else does. In other words, everything's perfectly
but we
equal.
We have to prove to ourselves,
everything's,
unless you're a believer.
But let me finish. The point is that there is a place, I'll suggest for you consideration, where that's true, but there are also many places where it's not true, where it is in fact a lie to say that everyone comes from the same place.
Comes to the same place.
And,
I'm not talking
and
about
comes
going
from
to,
the...
No,
comes,
no, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about that intangible place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody has a so-called belief. Atheists have beliefs,
mm-hmm.
which is nothing. You know, and you have to be open to the possibility that, of course, whatever I truly believe in, there's also the possibility that it doesn't exist.
Yeah,
but that's where the faith comes in. You find a group of people that believe in this one idea, bingo, and you have followers.
Well, my view is that you're right to say that openness is the key. The openness, though, is very specific, and I tried to articulate it just a few moments ago in terms
yeah,
of
but
how.
Also say, but it also comes down to a point of view to which you can say I know it for sure, blah 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 blah, but then you got another guy saying I think you're nuts.
Uh huh. And that has to be okay.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. It's a personal thing. you know. But it's all these logical ways to go about trying to find an answer to an illogical, intangible thing.
Okay, but I still don't agree that it just comes down to you have your view and I have my view, and there's no way to distinguish between them. My view is that it matters how we come to those views. And that would be Harris's point, for example.
But then you have the people on the other side that just believe in faith, and they don't know how, they don't care how it got to be.
Mm-hmm.
They just take it on faith. And they could care less whether you did all these certain steps to get there or whatever. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter.
But I think our point here is that when someone takes something on faith in the way that you're describing, that's not they're not really reaching the
they're
same
not
place.
Soul searchers.
Well, they're not reaching the same place. They've stopped at a way station, which is I'm holding on to a belief, and here it is.
Yeah, but you know how belief is. It go up to any person who believes this out of pure faith. And they're never, and whatever you
right.
A, B, C, D to what
exactly.
It is, they ain't buying it.
Right, exactly, and that's you know part of the.
That's part of the deal.
Yes, yeah, part of the subject of our talk, which is.
I mean, I'm not negating anything you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I agree with all of it.
Right.
You know.
Well, you're rearticulating part of the problem, and our claim is that what we refer to as a. Genuine or
you
legitimate spiritual path.
Yeah,
it doesn't matter
logical.
What the form is. Well, it doesn't matter what the particular form is. It's in some senses, I would say it's what it is counter belief, or it is
counter belief of what?
Counter belief in anything.
In any belief.
Right. In other words, it is a path of. Understanding the relativity of belief and thereby opening yourself up to something that transcends belief.
Yeah.
But
it's a logical way to go about it.
It's a logical way of removing it's a logical way of removing the obstacles to have a direct encountering with something.
Yeah.
And at that point, a good path stops trying to define it.
Well, no, I you know, because when you hit. There is no end, in other words. That's what keeps us always looking,
yeah.
You know. And we can narrow it down. We can find little things, you know. In the beginning, paths were easy. Then, as faith and everything gets more and more, they become more complicated. But you're just still following that original A, B, C, D, E. Well, C turns into, well, C, C1, C2, C3, as you learn more.
Yeah, I mean, right. I got that.
And you're still going to the same place.
Okay, so I think you had a question next.
Well, I think in the Middle Ages it was the doctrine, I believe, because it's absurd.
The doctrine?
I believe that because it is absurd.
Actually, that's from Greco-Roman times.
I believe because it's absurd.
No, well, because it's absurd.
Maybe earlier.
Tertullian,
one
of the early church fathers,
was
challenged on the absurdity of Christianity, and
gotcha.
He said, I believe because it is absurd.
Right.
So,
yeah.
I mean, what is... I don't know much about the background here, but I can speculate. It's probably in the wrong direction, but it could be something like, I believe because it's absurd, and... I do this because I see my own limitations. So I realize that it may just appear absurd to me because of my own limitations.
That's
and so the point of view that you advocate seems to put a lot of confidence in the ultimate sanity and intellectuality of the person who is on the road.
Let me...
And then this point of view seems to be more as a... I throw my hands up. I made so many mistakes in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And now I come to this doctrine that seems strange and intricate and wonderful. And I'm just going to embrace it.
Or surrender to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's certainly a way to go, and people have done it.
I think it's a If you, in terms of the language that we're talking about, that we've been evolving in this discussion, there's a wonderful freedom in that, and a great power in that kind of surrender. There's also well-defined pitfalls in that kind of surrender, because in one, you can do it in a way where you surrender yourself to God, and there's lots of examples of Hindu saints who have done this, and it's a very beautiful thing. You know, they become God intoxicated, and they seem to blossom forth as these great saint-like beings. And then there's people who go through a born-again experience who become holy assholes instead of just ordinary assholes. And yet, you know, from a superficial point of view, they've both surrendered to something larger to themselves. And the problem is, well, you know, what are you surrendering to? What is the actual methodology of the surrender? Are you genuinely, objectively giving up identification with yourself as being a particular someone, or are you hooking into a belief system that justifies you and somehow distinguishes you and segregates you from everyone else because you're now part of the club? From an exterior point of view, it's hard to tell the difference, except by what the ultimate manifestation of this process of surrender is. And this gets back to our contention earlier that there is a kind of objectivity. If someone goes through this process of surrender and ends up like a saint that truly, by all apparent observations, has no consideration of themselves and has a profound effect on other people and inducing a sense of freedom in them, then, you know, I'd probably argue they have surrendered. They have taken that path appropriately. If they become Jerry Falwell, I'd argue, well, I don't think so. So I would still stand by our earlier contention that there is a kind of an objective metric by which one can look at how one relates to one's humanness in its incomplete form and in its a spiritually realized form, and that there are reliable guidelines which can take us to at least the gateway so that we can walk through the gate, in a sense, in a way that ultimately we're the ones who will be the sole experiencer of. But
Hinduism does that. Hinduism has, you can follow a path of faith. Or like in yoga, Raja Yoga,
right?
Going into the self.
There's different paths.
Let me completely agree that it matters who or what you surrender to, but it also matters what or who is surrendering in you. Okay, and that's a difficult. That's actually a process too. Okay, and that's where someone like Tertullian, for a while, probably was able to experience a much broader, more spacious world from whatever act of surrender, if you know, however he constituted it and thought about it. Almost any act of genuine surrender will do that. But in this ongoing process, we need to learn not just to surrender one or two or three times. We have to learn to surrender as a process. The process of surrender is part of what we are learning to do. And that involves this, or I'm going to offer for your consideration again, this distinction between the non-phenomenal self, what you might call the soul, if it exists, and this egoic construction that we are so used to identifying with. So if we surrender to, if the ego is trained to surrender to the non-phenomenal self, what does that mean? What does that feel like? How is that distinct from surrendering to an idea about the world? Okay, so that's a distinction that I'm going to suggest for you might help us understand how some surrenders are more effective than others. If the nature of the non-phenomenal self is different than, as it would presumably be, from ideas which are in the phenomenal world, at least in my version of my view of the phenomenal world, then surrender to the non-phenomenal self, and whether it's a Hindu non-phenomenal big S self or a little S self, however you want to define
it,
or no self, right? A Buddhist no self or whatever, or whether it's surrender to a deity self that one attempts to merge with, that's different than some of these other surrenders. So it matters who you're surrendering to, but it also matters what part of you is being asked to surrender or required to surrender. And one of the things that the practices that Stuart talked about earlier, the self-observation practice that we do, for example, but there's plenty of other practices in other traditions that do similar things, is that it gives us information about the distinction between and the nature of the egoic self and what it is that can surrender to usefully. We want to surrender to something that's going to help us, or we want to learn how to establish the habit of surrender to things greater than ourselves that will actually take us where we want to go, to this place of non-identification as an ongoing process in our lives. That's my suggestion. And the problem with surrendering to an idea, no matter how sublime, no matter how grand, is that ultimately it is necessarily and decidedly self-limiting. Whereas the non-phenomenal self is not self-limiting. Or so we claim.
If I can add a little thing, it seems you're talking about two things. One is what you surrender to,
mm-hmm.
and this other, this process of kind of continuous surrender. And I don't quite follow the latter one, because it seems to me that surrender is you lose your agency. And you can only lose your agency once, so...
It's virginity.
If you surrender and then say, oops,
well.
Mistake, another sound.
That assumes.
So you maybe add something, and I don't quite understand how you can describe it as a process of continuous surrender.
Let me just first, you said that when you surrender, you lose your agency, and then you're done. Our claim is that actually our ordinary state of consciousness is fragmented, and there is no one self, but rather a large compendium of competing selves that all represent perspectives, identifications, psychological moments. And so when Rob is describing the process is surrendering the agency of each of these identified states of self, so that ultimately, over an extended period of time, there can be the surrender, and then you're done. That's the idea. But
so there is an end?
Well... I wouldn't go that far.
We said it was done.
Yeah, I'm being metaphorical in this sense, in that that there it's the position of surrendering, just by the nature of being an organism, there's an ongoing invitation to identify. And so the process of surrendering is often, my sense of surrendering is more of letting go as opposed to giving up agency. It's not resisting. It's allowing. It's accepting in some sense of what is, and so much of the moments of psychological identification define themselves in opposition to something else. I'm mad because something's happened, or I'm frustrated because I'm not getting my way, or I'm happy because this set of conditions have happened. So the ongoing process is a process of finding those moments of identification in ourselves and releasing those.
The other distinction is that as I suggested earlier, is if there are these two aspects of who we are, there's the egoic self, and then there's this perhaps non-phenomenal self, then there can be a point. Very few people reach it in a human lifetime, but people do reach it, and I'm here to say that it can be done. But it's a point where the habit of identification with egoic manifestations has been dispensed with. That doesn't mean every little shred is totally gone, but it's sort of like you create a different habit to replace that habit, and that's this habit of the process of surrender of continuous surrender that Stuart's talking about, or acceptance that Stuart's talking about. But that is not the ego. The ego cannot do that. The ego does go in little bursts, little blip, 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 blip. Sometimes they're big ones, sometimes they're little ones, but this other thing, that too needs to learn. I'll offer you for your consideration. The non-phenomenal self may need to learn too. That may need to learn about how to be associated with a body in this realm. But that's a different kind of learning and a different kind of surrender than this big initial problem, which is to deal with this big, heap of egoic habits that keeps us ensnarled moment by moment in all kinds of obstacles.
Is there a question over here?
Well, I would just like to say something in support of the idea of surrender being an ongoing, almost continuous process, because I've been involved with a couple of Western teachers who I would say had attained or opened up spiritually in a very powerful way, in that being around them, sitting with them, meditating with them, they were capable of opening other people up. They opened this space up spiritually for other people, certainly for me. And yet both of these people had some serious psychological problems and were really, a little screwed up in certain areas of their lives. And I, at the time, I had real trouble trying to reconcile that.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
So if you're nuts, that doesn't necessarily mean you're not an awakened person.
Yeah, but if you're an awakened person, it doesn't necessarily mean you're not nuts.
Right.
Well, there's the model that we find useful in the Fourth Way tradition is the model of an organism has three operating centers, a mental, an emotional, a moving, and a motor center. You can divide it into seven if you want, sometimes we can awaken in one center or have clarity in one center and still have a bunch of habits we haven't looked at or confronted in another center.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very common, in fact. And, traditions can be more or less balanced depending on where they focus their attention and where someone focuses their energy of practice. But someone can have all sorts of, emotional hang-ups, and sometimes that doesn't matter at all. It just becomes more energy to work with in a group situation. Other times it's a reflection that they there's more to do.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we find it's always useful to never assume you're done, but to constantly be open to the possibility of growing.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't, but I guess the thing I'd say is it doesn't invalidate their teaching. That's what they teach, that's objective, is not invalidated, but it may not be a complete teaching in one sense, or one may outgrow the relationship with that particular teacher because you've got what you're going to get from them and it's time to get something else. Or to,
yeah, if they have problem, if the situation, I don't know who these people are, and it doesn't matter. But if, you know, someone is clear in one area and you can learn from them, why not learn from them? If you're drawn to them in your life, and once you've gotten what they had to give in that area, then it's fine to, it seems to me, to move on to someone who can help with another area. In our tradition, it's important. Gurdjieff was very big, and you know, our founder and his teachers were very big on attempting very explicitly to harmonize the three centers, such that there's not a lot of imbalance as much as possible. But that's a difficult. That's not an easy task to accomplish. That's for sure. So, other comments, questions?
Yeah. I've been sort of exploring the idea that it's easier to arrive at truth through metaphor than. Mm-hmm. Than by rational process. Mm-hmm. And there may be not a large truth arrived at, but perhaps little truths that occur when there's a realization, and very often they can't even be expressed verbally. Mm-hmm. And you seem to be, Rob, saying before that if you can hold a notion that is a metaphorical one and one that is a scientific one at the same time, trying not to use the word believe.
oh, go ahead.
accept both of them simultaneously. Mm-hmm. That you've achieved something, and it seems part of me wants to say you can't do both at the same time. That there has to be that you can follow a metaphorical path somehow and arrive at something, but you can't also do the scientific at the same time.
And, well, it's true. Sorry. Go ahead.
Well, although I don't believe. But there's part of me that totally accepts what you said. mm-hmm. There is this kind of dichotomy in my way of thinking.
Right. Well, the ego can't accept that view. Uh-huh. For the ego, it's all or nothing, basically. As we generally find the ego. We were just reading something last night about good and evil. This the subject of good and evil, is discussed in this book that Stuart was just mentioning by Gurdjieff. It's also a big subject
in which book? I'm sorry.
This book by Gurdjieff that Stuart was just discussing.
All and Everything.
It's called All and Everything.
Yeah.
And it's also a big subject in a number of Buddhist traditions as well. That is the difficulties that arise when you accept good and evil. And it's the ego, essentially, that lives in the world of good and evil. And the ego can only go one way or the other. That's why you find people, the phenomenon that I mentioned earlier, where when they're 20, they're Marxists, and when they're 40, they're, something opposite, right? Or ostensibly opposite. They haven't given up the habit of belief, the habit of identification, which creates a situation where you have these polar opposites, and you're on the good side, whatever that is at the moment, and on the bad side, everyone else is, or these other people are. So, but that's the egoic place. The metaphorical place, and this is the point that Stuart was making earlier, that Gurdjieff has pointed to, is that there is a way of understanding this metaphorical, allegorical way of understanding that is a function of an aspect of being that is not egoic. Okay. And so it doesn't have to identify with one side or the other at a particular time. I don't know if that helps.
Well, it seems to me that the value of metaphor is that it tricks the ego.
That is part of it. Yeah. But
or circumvents it somehow, and it goes to more to the core of your
yes, being. Yes. Yes. That is right. But if the ego is still intact, remember the way the ego works. When the ego is still intact, it's going to come right back in and take over. And you're going to think about, oh, that's good and that's bad again.
Good metaphor.
What's that?
Good metaphor.
Terrible metaphor. All that sort of thing. So the issue has got to be, you know, who's minding the store, as my teacher used to say. That is, who or what part of consciousness is minding the store? Who or what part of consciousness is present? And what we're suggesting for your consideration is that it is possible to contact and eventually liberate from the egoic constraints that it is currently enmeshed in, this aspect of consciousness that speaks metaphorically, thinks metaphorically, thinks faster than the ego, thinks more productively and more clearly than the ego, and thinks not, as Stuart pointed out, not just in the intellectual realm, but assimilating the information from the entirety of the organism, including the emotional and physical aspects. But it's not an easy task to get there, given the kind of impressions we get growing up in our culture, in all human cultures, pretty much.
So I think we have time for one last question.
One last question.
Did you have a question? Or?
Well, I was just going to sort of make an assertion that in some way, over the last few centuries, these two modes of knowing have become weirdly dissociated and antagonistic. You know, the people who essentially created the scientific method were part of a religious framework of looking. Mm-hmm. You know, they were investigating the natural world, but they believed in God. And I think it could be argued that over the last couple of centuries, modernism or the Enlightenment, however you want to say it, has sort of dissociated an attempt to look at the world objectively, an attempt to look at the world metaphorically, and made them antagonistic to each other. And you have fundamentalist Christianity, you know, Jerry Falwell on one hand and Richard Dawkins on the other.
Well, Gurdjieff points out that he says that this ability to think allegorically, as he puts it, was common a couple of thousand years ago, and more common the further back in history you go. So maybe it's an even longer term trend, if he's right.
Well, you know, even in the history of Christianity, the early church fathers argued that you had to look at scripture in multiple modes, and one of them was allegory.
Right.
You know, you had to look at, it might be a literal meaning, but there might also be like an ethical or spiritual meaning or an allegorical meaning. Mm-hmm. And it just, you had to look for all of those. And I'm sure that's true of a lot of different traditions. I don't think interpreting the Quran as literalistically or fundamentalistically as it tends to be now was necessarily the case when it originated. The Sufis certainly looked at it with a lot more depth.
Hmm. Did you have a final comment? Or?
Well, I can barely wrap my mind around this Ken Wilber, okay, but I think we really can't deny that we are, in our age, going through an evolution of human consciousness. And from what little I can glean from what I've read of his, that human consciousness evolves just like species evolve, and that there each belief systems and psychological systems are complete and entire unto their time, and that there's a process that's ongoing that's going to take us to another step, so to speak, as a way of understanding at another level, and God knows what where it'll ultimately go. But it's kind of like what's going on, the argument between religion and science right now is part of that transition, and we're going to go to, it's going to evolve to something at some point where humanity is going to understand, according to him,
mm-hmm.
I think, where humanity is going to understand things in a incrementally more evolved way, and that's going to be have spiritual as well as social and cultural and etc. benefits.
Well, thank you. I it would be nice if that happens to be the case,
yeah.
And I would say that in terms of, you know, our practice or what we look at, it'd be nice if that's true, but it doesn't have to be true. You know, the world could just keep going on exactly the way it is with its paradoxes and internal conflicts, and it doesn't change the opportunity that's always available to any one of us, which is to step beyond, you know, the realm of belief and step beyond the realm of identification into another set of possibilities for us.
Yeah, that's the opportunity and responsibility that we have personally. You know, it's nice to think about these bigger issues, but ultimately the only thing we can do ourselves is examine our own consciousnesses, examine our own lives, examine our own organisms as they exist, in order to become as clear as we can about what we're doing, who we are, and why we're doing what we're doing. So so that's what it returns to. That's where I return when I think about these grand issues, is, of course, and we all do, it's like, oh, right. And so here I am in this body, and it feels a certain way. And this room feels a certain way with all of us sitting in it. And this town feels a certain way with all of these people in this town doing what they do in this town. And here I am in that, and what do I do now? So, thank you. Shall we?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. Munir Rupakshi has adopted the Buddhist custom of dana, or generosity. So there is a dana bowl on the counter, and a portion goes to our speakers, and a portion goes to the store, so we can continue to have events here on Thursday evenings. And don't forget the tea tasting on Saturday, because you'll have a lot of fun. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.